Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It is my pleasure to welcome back James Reyes Picknall. Welcome back, James.
Hello. Great to be here with you again, James.
For those of you that may not be familiar with yourself, James, you're the best-selling author of Uptime, Strategies for Excellence in Maintenance Management, now in its third edition, which is the book that got me started in maintenance management. So thank you again for that.
Quite welcome.
You are a mechanical engineer, and you have had a career spanning 39 years in maintenance and asset management, beginning with a ship's engineer in the Canadian Navy, moving on to various roles within maintenance and reliability through the corporate world, and then moving into consulting. And in 2004, you started Conscientious Asset, and you've been in business with that for over 12 years now. Have I missed anything big within your background?
Well, that pretty much sums it up really well. I'd say closer to 40 years actually now, I think. But aside from that, yeah, mechanical engineer, Navy, petrochemicals, shipbuilding, aerospace and consulting, and consulting's covered a raft of different industries where I've worked. Pretty much all heavy industry where physical assets are key to profitability and service delivery for those industries.
Very good. And I'm assuming over that vast course of time and seeing all these different industries, the term reliability improvement has probably come up time and time again. So what does that actually mean then?
Well, it's kind of an interesting term because technically one could argue it's wrong because reliability in actual fact is designed into assets by virtue of the fact that the components, the materials, the way things are operated, the stresses they're submitted to really dictate to a large extent the reliability of the asset. So you design it for a certain service, and depending on how well you've done that, it will have a certain inherent level of reliability that it's capable of. When people say reliability, the improvement, I don't think they think about that. They think about getting better reliability than they're getting today. Which implies, and usually is quite accurate, that they're not getting that built-in capability the asset really has to begin with. And yeah, you do get that term a lot. People want it. They don't always understand it as well as they might, but it is a big target for them. Now, the other term that I hear a lot, which kind of disturbs me a bit when I hear it, is they want to cut cost in maintenance. I tell people, if they listen, that you really can't cut cost in maintenance directly. You have to get at it indirectly, and you do that by improving reliability. So if you invest in reliability, then you will get the reliability improvement. And in the process of doing that, you will actually reduce your maintenance cost. But it does take a little bit of upfront thought and effort and in some cases money invested into reliability improvement initiatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And you raised a couple of good points there. The one is the inherent reliability, trying to get back to that inherent reliability of the asset, not over the inherent reliability, because you can't do that unless you're doing some sort of redesign, you know, replacing the asset, that sort of thing. So
that's correct.
But in terms of the cost savings piece, I remember reading another book, and they talked, maybe it was a presentation, but it talked about the bow wave effect. And it's essentially that in order to bring down maintenance costs, you have a little increase, the bow wave, to get it going, to get things in place, to get stuff moving, and then you can bring down cost afterwards. You need that upfront investment, whether it's time, people, resources, to make it happen. Only then will you start to see the long-term sustainable decrease in maintenance costs.
That's pretty accurate. I think a lot of people think of that bow wave as being money all the time, but I'm glad to hear you say that it's an investment of time and energy effort, process change. It's not necessarily an added cost. And in fact, you know, depending on how far from your reliability goals you are, you may well be able to pay for that effort quite easily, quite quickly. Because reliability improvements, they don't just save you money. Saving you money comes from doing less maintenance, which means fewer breakdowns. It actually means more availability or productivity coming from that asset, and hence more revenue generation capability. So the real benefit is not cost saving at all. It's the added revenue that which usually dwarfs the cost savings that you can achieve.
Oh, absolutely. You know, what is 5 points of OEE worth to certain manufacturers? You know, that's, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars over a week or month in some cases. So definitely exactly. Much better than the small amount of savings, like you mentioned, in maintenance costs.
Yeah, not long ago, I created a little spreadsheet to show what that change in OEE means. and it makes it pretty obvious when you look at the numbers on a spreadsheet and start fiddling with them that the maintenance savings themselves are minuscule compared with what you can get. In most cases.
Absolutely. Now, with this approach to improving reliability and all these asks for improving reliability, what is the best way to go about that? How do you actually start a reliability improvement to bring the current reliability up to the inherent reliability?
Well, the best approaches, in my opinion, are actually a combination of things. From purely reliability, assuming you've got the ability to start on it, and now I'll talk to that in a second. But the two things that I see working well in combination are reliability-centered maintenance and root cause failure analysis. The root cause failure analysis deals with the current bad actors, if you will, the critical assets that are causing a lot of downtime, a lot of cost, and excessive safety or environmental non-compliances. You know, those are the things you want to solve. Those are the problems you want to solve really quickly. And root cause analysis is really good at targeting known existing problem areas and leading to solutions for them. Inherent in doing it is part of the logic we use in reliability-centered maintenance for decision-making once we've identified the failure modes and their effects. Now, root cause failure analysis, however, on its own is not enough. It's only good for the problems you have or have already had, and you've already suffered consequences before you know where the problems are. And that's not something you want. You'd never fly on an airplane if they were designing the maintenance program using root cause failure analysis methods.
Definitely not.
But you would fly on one these days, and they all use reliability-centered maintenance. It's a more proactive approach. It doesn't wait for the failures to have happened. It actually forecasts what failures could happen and are likely to happen and proactively make decisions about managing the failures and their consequences so that you minimize the impacts on business safety, the environment, and so on. So those two together, I think, are important. You know, root cause kind of slays the dragons you're fighting today. RCM for the critical assets slays the dragons you'll have to fight tomorrow if you don't do something today. Now, I mentioned that when I started answering this one, that you have to be ready for them. I think a big mistake a lot of people make is to jump straight to RCM or straight to RCFA because they have an obvious problem. And while that's not a bad idea, if they're not already capable of getting work achieved on schedule, then their maintenance work management processes are probably not stable enough to sustain a good reliability program, even if it's just a single solution for one problem that you've solved with RCFA. You need to be able to execute proactive maintenance, preventive, predictive maintenance, detective maintenance on schedule, or you defeat the purpose of it. And if you can't stick to a schedule very well, it's because of a number of factors. You're probably not scheduling properly. You may not have materials available when you schedule, you know, so the integration to work management might be bad. Your planning might be inadequate. The parts you have may not be the right parts, even if you've got them. You may still be very much in a firefighting type of mode, waiting for things to break and then fixing them. And if that's the case, it's very hard to stick to a schedule because you're always pulling people away to fight the fire du jour. So all of that has to be kind of stable for reliability improvement efforts to really take hold and do you some good. And so there's kind of two parts to that. You need the reliability component, which is all about doing the right work. But you also have to be able to get the work done the right way, and that means with some stability in work management. And that can take quite a bit of work to achieve as well.
Absolutely. The work management piece is huge in trying to get working and organized and moving in the right direction if you don't have anything in place. I've always been the advocate of you need to have planning, scheduling, and your spares program running well before you can really start looking at the effectiveness of the PM programs. You can really start doing that sort of stuff, because if you can't do them on time, how do you know if they're effective?
Exactly. And there is a school of thought that would argue that if you start doing reliability work, you'll soon realize that you need to clean up your act in work management. But I haven't seen work in practice.
No.
If you're busy trying to slay alligators, you're not going to be thinking about draining the swamp, and it just doesn't work that way. I've also seen people argue that you can make huge savings in planning and scheduling alone, and while they certainly have benefit on their own, they really don't deliver on the promise. You know, yes, planned and scheduled work is much cheaper than reactive, reactionary type work, but it's only going to work for you if you can do a substantial amount of it. And you can only do that if you actually get the numbers of breakdowns reduced, which means having a good reliability program. So there's kind of a cyclical thing going on here where to get the benefit of planning and scheduling, you have to be able to get more proactive work done, which means more focus on reliability. And that'll help deliver fewer failures, which gives you the stability to get the planning and the scheduling improved. So the two kind of go hand in hand in a total program where you're going to get the maximum benefit back from it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, I think it was the manufacturing game. They had a table that showed the benefits if you're just doing planning, the benefits if you're doing just scheduling, if you're doing those combined. Then what happened when you introduced defect elimination in combination with that and a PM program? And you know, the results were just dramatic. If you were just doing scheduling, you were going to lose, I don't know, a percentage of uptime. And if you did planning and scheduling together, you might gain one or two. If you did PM compliance in its own or PM program on its own, you might lose 3% of uptime. But when you did all of them with defect elimination, it was like, I think 11 or 14%. I can't remember the exact table. Increase in uptime.
Exactly. And the exact numbers are going to vary from company to company, industry to industry, but that's absolutely correct. Any one of those things on its own might actually reduce your uptime. Introduce a PM program on its own. If you haven't got the right PMs, you're going to actually introduce too much work, and you may even be inducing failures. I've seen that happen many times. It's sad, but it actually happens. People are very well intentioned in their PM program introduction, but they kind of miss the technical aspects of it and do too much of the wrong kind of maintenance and actually create problems for themselves.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL Blended Learning for Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. This SMRP-accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com. Now, assuming we have a basic work management and spares management program in place, so we have a little bit of time to do a reliability improvement, if you will. Should this be a large in scope, or should this be a very narrowly focused activity?
I'm not a fan of narrow because it takes too long to cover the whole waterfront, and people want business results quickly. So I tend to go broader in scope, but I don't suggest that you apply it to all your assets. First thing I would do is perform a asset criticality analysis, if you don't already have one, and understand what are your most critical assets from the perspective of uptime, reliability, safety and environmental impacts when they fail, and target the more critical ones. And actually, I even do that at the system level, target the systems and find out what's most critical, and then look at the assets within those systems. But what I want to do is target the reliability improvement effort, because it does take some analytical process and time. Target that on those most critical assets first. Now, if you can create a cutoff point in your criticality analysis between what's critical and what's not, and then the stuff that's not critical, as long as it's not a bad actor and not eating your lunch today, just continue doing whatever you're doing right now with it. So you don't have to do all your assets, but I do believe the critical stuff really does warrant this kind of more scientific approach. And of course, for it to work, the work management piece has to happen, and that covers everything. So you get quite a bit of benefit with a more targeted program. But I wouldn't narrowly focus it only in one area unless you only have one critical area, and then that would work.
Okay, so you use asset criticality at the system level to identify what key systems we need to focus in on. Then from there, we dive into those critical systems, identifying the critical assets, and begin our RCM, our defect elimination on those critical assets. Correct?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Now, as we're doing this, you know, asset criticality, not even just asset criticality, but the overall program, who should be on that reliability improvement team? Is it just maintenance? Is it just the technicians? Who should actually be on there helping to drive these changes?
Okay, definitely not just maintenance. Any program that's just maintenance will fail. Maintenance is pretty much low man on the totem pole in most organizations, right? You're kind of seen by the finance people as a necessary evil, a cost. You're seen by the operations people as those pesky maintenance guys that always want downtime to do their work. You're just not the most respected group in the organization, unfortunately. If you try and do it on your own, you're going to flop. The other reason for it, aside from that, is that maintenance on its own does not control reliability by any means. A lot of failures are induced by human error, and a lot of that comes from production people, operations people. There are errors created during repairs, and maintenance has control over that. But if an asset is run beyond its capability, So it's being overstressed, essentially. You know, that's very much in the hands of the operations and production people. And the maintenance people can't do a thing about it, you know, except fix it when it breaks. And it will break if they keep overloading it consistently over a period of time or significantly overload it even for short periods of time. So operations and maintenance definitely have to be a part of it. I suggest engineering be available to provide specialist help if the maintenance and operations people can't quite figure out the best way to go. Another key participant, believe it or not, is finance. And I don't mean accounting. I'm not interested in the bean counters at all. I'm only interested in saving money. Talk about somebody from finance who's actually got business sense and is interested in seeing what reliability can deliver to the organization in terms of increased output and productivity, not just the savings and cost. And that's because of what we said earlier, the cost savings are usually minor compared with the other benefits. So maintenance, production, engineering, occasionally finance needs to be there, certainly backing you up. They'll help when you come up with an improvement idea that needs some funding. If they see a business case, they can really help you make it happen. And of course, sponsorship. Somebody at a high level, like your general manager at a site or COO in a corporation, really do need to be on board with a reliability improvement effort, because it's going to touch on different areas of the business. And if you don't have everybody who might be touched upon involved, you need somebody senior enough to get the attention of those who aren't participating, and that's where sponsorship comes in very, very handy. So your reliability improvement team, there's actually several. There's on the floor operations maintenance, right? But once you get past that, you start to bring in the other groups to help.
Yeah, and I think that's vital. It's that cross-functional buy-in, the capability building across the different functions. like you said, having finance there to justify and be able to help build that business case and understand the overall impact to the organization. If we're able to take out this much cost of goods sold, what is the impact on the bottom line to that down the, you know, sometimes it's much greater than just what the cost, what the savings are in cost of goods sold. Sometimes there's all kinds of other things that add up to that and make a bigger difference for the organization.
That's right. And so they definitely need to be there. I've actually found that where I have had the finance people involved, they are probably my single biggest ally in terms of getting things done, because they're usually kind of impatient. And I find that works, because, you know, while the maintenance and the operations people will come up with excuses for why you can't do it today or this week, the finance people will say, well, here's the money. I want the money back because it's way more than I'm going to give you. Do it now. And they become quite the ally. They may not always understand the technical reasons behind what they're supporting, but once they realize that this thing is a moneymaker for them, they get on board and they really help drive it. And they usually have the ear of other senior executives. You know, the finance people usually carry an awful lot of weight when they're in meetings and when it comes time to decision making.
Well, absolutely. That's how all the businesses keep score at the end of the day. So everyone is well connected with finance. So
yep.
Now we have our team, we have our area focus. What are the actual steps to doing this reliability analysis? Is it just doing an RCM analysis, or, you know, some root cause failure analysis?
Well, I kind of look at it as a program. First thing is make sure you're ready for it, and that's the stability and work management and maintenance schedule compliance. Well, once I see good schedule compliance, and by that I mean all your work is being scheduled, or nearly all your work is being scheduled, and about 70%+ of it is actually getting done on schedule. All right, now that's not that easy to achieve, but if you're headed in that direction, then I think you're ready for it. But if your schedule compliance on all the work is really low, you're not ready. You know, I've seen places where they say, oh, yeah, our PM schedule compliance is nearly 100%. You know, how much of the total workload is PM? And they'll say, well, maybe 5%. I'm thinking, well, so you're at 5% schedule compliance overall. Not good enough. It's got to be on everything. Once you're in that position, then your asset criticality analysis should be done if it doesn't already exist. I would then tackle or use root cause failure analysis for any critical bad actors that are out there and still eating your lunch. Another step I use, which I didn't mention earlier, is PM optimization. It uses similar logic to reliability-centered maintenance for decision-making. But it applies it kind of in reverse, if you will, to your existing PM program. Most organizations have a PM program in place. They're often somewhat inadequate. They're either overdoing the wrong kind of maintenance, or there's not enough there. They're at the wrong frequencies. They might be targeting the wrong failure modes or failure modes that aren't really going to happen. So there's some optimization can usually be done, and you leverage the RCM knowledge to do that quickly. The problem with it is, of course, it only tackles where you already have PMs in place. If you don't have a PM, it won't necessarily identify new failure modes and lead you down the path that RCM will. So it's kind of a quick cleanup on an existing program to help boost value in the short term, and then apply RCM on your critical asset. Now to do that, you're going to need a little bit of training, and the training for RCM actually is really, really helpful to have if you're going to do PM optimization and root cause failure analysis. So even though training in RCM is not intended to be used in those two areas, it does help a lot in terms of getting people's thinking aligned correctly. So I like to do that training kind of early, use it in a root cause failure analysis. And I'm not talking a really fancy technique here. You know, root cause failure analysis does not have to be overly sophisticated to solve problems. PM optimization, bit of a process, kind of like RCM, but much quicker. And as I say, it doesn't cover as much scope. But both of those will deliver some value quickly for you. And then RCM it can also deliver value quickly. It's just that the analysis process is more rigorous and really not worth doing except on critical assets. So kind of step, get ready. Make sure your compliance is good, criticality analysis, root cause on the bad actors, PMO on your existing PM program, and NRCM on all your critical assets. And I think if you deploy it that way, you're going to have some pretty substantial results.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.